You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to Brookings. Thank you for coming. I'm Michael O'Hanlon, Senior Fellow at Brookings, and I've had the honor of reading this book in draft form and enjoying the process along the way and learning a great deal from Elizabeth Ferris in the course of her research, her writings, her activities that many of you I know collaborate with her on, and this fine book. And it's a provocative book. It's a history in some ways and a good backgrounder and primer for people who don't know the field very well, but it's also an effort to make sense of how things have shifted in the international humanitarian world, and also, as you know from the title, to underscore the limitations of humanitarian intervention and of the effort at impartial humanitarian intervention at a moment in world history when the humanitarian side of disputes and conflicts is becoming more and more central in whether and how we decide to intervene. In other words, there are plenty of tensions and paradoxes the book wrestles with and challenges that it sees ahead for the policy community. And, of course, that's what we're here to discuss today. So very briefly, I'll just say a couple words about Elizabeth. She will speak for about 15 minutes, and Richard will then also speak for about 10 minutes, and then we'll go straight to a discussion with you unless I have one or two clarifying queries for them en route. And we'll have about a half hour, therefore, with you to discuss the broad issues in the book, as well as, of course, any specific questions you want to raise and get at regarding challenges, dilemmas like the current Libya crisis and anything else that's on your mind. One more thing I would just substantively highlight from the book that struck me in reading this and in talking with Elizabeth is the fact that, of course, so much of her work centers today on internally displaced persons, and as she points out, many of whom are not just internally displaced within their country of origin, that's the definition of the term, of course, but interposed within urban populations or other populations that make it difficult, in a sense, to treat them, help them directly, because they are still part of their country's politics, still part of their country's broader demographics, which raises all sorts of challenging political and operational questions about how we can try to help them. So these are, again, many of the challenges that Elizabeth wrestles with. As you know, those of you who are familiar with her work and her career, she's been getting at these issues from many different directions for many years. She spent virtually her entire career in the broader world of international humanitarian response, much of it before coming to Brookings in 2006 in Europe, previous position at the World Council of Churches. So again, the broad issue of international humanitarian response and then within that, internally displaced persons has been her area of expertise. So she's capable of taking a broad perspective as well as getting at the specific challenges that people face in the field today. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming the author of this fine book, The Politics of Protection, The Limits of Humanitarian Action, Elizabeth Ferris.
Thank you, Mike, for your kind words, and thanks to all of you for coming. I'm especially grateful to see some representatives of the U.S. government here, because on Friday we weren't quite certain what was going to happen. And thanks to family and friends and those of you who know a lot about protection and those of you who perhaps don't know very much at all. When I first began my work in humanitarian affairs way back in 1985, I was a protection person from the first day. Other people could deal with the nitty-gritty of logistics and nutrition and setting up therapeutic feeding centers, and I didn't have those technical skills. But I could certainly figure out the relationship between the kinds of assistance provided and the way in which people were protected. Where a latrine is placed in a camp, for example, can make a difference in whether or not women get raped or attacked in the middle of the night. So I spent years, along with many others, urging that protection not be considered as a separate department, but that it be mainstreamed into everything that humanitarian actors do. I mean, that was my life as a protection person. And then in the 1990s, we had Somalia and Bosnia and Rwanda, where terrible dilemmas emerged for humanitarian actors trying to protect people on the ground through humanitarian assistance when those with the power to make things happen, to stop the violence or the genocide or the massacres, were either not present or unwilling or very late in responding. And these were terrible humanitarian ethical dilemmas, if you will? Do you help somebody escape and thereby save their lives, even if you're contributing to ethnic cleansing, for example? I remember a young man that I had cheerfully advised in March of 1994 to by all means go to Rwanda. It's a beautiful little country. As a UN volunteer, he went, and the next month genocide broke out. He eventually ended up working with UNHCR, and I remember him with tears in his eyes and his voice shaking as he said to me, "You know, I was outside of Kisangani with a group of UNHCR staff. We stood on one side of the river, and we heard the screams and the moans and the cries of hundreds of people being massacred. We could not stop it." And he looked at me and he said, "I work for a refugee protection agency, but we could not prevent, we could not protect those being slaughtered at Kisangani." So I should be happy that after, in these days, certainly over the last decade, everybody is doing protection. In my world, the humanitarian world, there are guidebooks and manuals and handbooks and terms of reference and training courses and standards and indicators, and this is a wonderful thing. When you step back from the humanitarian world, protection has moved to be center stage. Since 2000, the UN Security Council has said protection of civilians is central to everything we do. With one exception, every peacekeeping operation has had protection of civilians as part of its mandate. A long process to develop the concept of responsibility to protect, and understanding that it was the responsibility of the international community to act when governments fail to exercise their sovereign responsibility, a concept developed here at Brookings by my predecessors. Within the military, protection of civilians became central to the whole counterinsurgency strategy. Everybody was doing protection. Everybody talking about protection. This should have made me happy, but instead I felt a profound sense of unease. If everybody's doing it, if all actors are involved in protecting people, if everything is protection, have we in fact lost something very precious? One of the problems is perhaps the definition that was developed originally by the International Committee of the Red Cross and endorsed by the Interagency Standing Committee and most humanitarian actors, which defines protection as, quote, "all activities to ensure the full respect for the rights of individuals in accord with the letter and spirit of the relevant bodies of law. All activities, full respect for the rights." If everything respecting all rights was protection, it almost put everything on the same level. Educating kids is protection because you're preventing them from being recruited by armed gangs. Developing livelihoods or income generation opportunities or protection strategies because it keeps women from being forced into prostitution. Voter registration and participation of communities and distribution of seeds, all often presented in a context of protection. So that's the reason I wrote this book. As Mike said, I began, as you know, most books do, with a historical background and traced the development of three strands of international law. International humanitarian law, which really began its roots perhaps in the 10th century when there were agreements that the women and children and orphans and widows should be spared the vicissitudes of battle and also the property of the Roman Catholic Church very, very early in the development. Through chivalry with certain norms that people, some categories of people were to be protected. Through the development of modern international humanitarian law with its injunctions against attacking or harming those soldiers who were not in combat roles at a particular moment in time. International humanitarian law also gave us some basic humanitarian principles, principles of impartiality and independence and neutrality, that humanitarian action was to be a neutral action, not to take sides, but to offer assistance to those on the basis of need and the basis of need alone. I then look at refugee law, which many of you know, international human rights law. And in all three of these areas, you see an expansion, starting relatively narrow and then expanding to include other groups and other issues of concern. In human rights, an initial focus on civil and political rights, you know, changing into economic, social, cultural rights, really paralleling and contributing to the development of protection as an all-inclusive concept. I look at the relationship between these humanitarian principles and protection. You know, the word protection is a nice word. It's a noble word. It's a word that has a little paternalistic overtone. You know, the strong protect the weak, if you will. But when it's put together with humanitarian principles, sometimes it's difficult to protect people and still be neutral. I've often used the analogy, for example, of a woman who comes to a doctor with a broken arm. Her husband has beaten her. She's a victim of domestic violence. Her arm is broken. The doctor sets her own arm. That's a neutral act, a humanitarian act. But the minute the doctor says to her, have you thought about getting a restraining order? Or there's a safe house over here. Or maybe you should do something to address the causes of that violence. The minute he tries to protect her and not just set her arm, he's crossed a line in terms of neutrality. He's no longer neutral. He's taken sides. You know, his side is the woman and not her husband. And that dilemma, I think, is one that's played out in 1,000 different ways in humanitarian work today. The book then looks at actions by the Security Council, peacekeeping operations, the development of this wonderful, but today very much stalled concept of responsibility to protect, and looks particularly at the intersection with humanitarian dilemmas. You know, sometimes the people most in need of protection and assistance are the most difficult to reach and present the greatest threat to humanitarian workers trying to access them. I spend a chapter on natural disasters and protection. This is a relatively new field. It wasn't really until the tsunami of 2004 that we began to realize that people displaced or affected by natural disasters also had protection needs. Then there's a chapter on who pays for protection, because if you follow the money and see the extent to which protection programs are supported, particularly in comparison with others, there is a revealing conclusions. Finally, I look at some of the future challenges. One are changes in the nature of conflict. Most conflict now and likely in the future will be protracted. It will last for a long time. I think the era of quick wars, if they ever existed, has come to an end. Most humanitarians are much better at responding to emergency situations than to situations where refugees and internally displaced people are displaced for decades. A couple of years ago, somebody calculated that the average number of years a refugee had been a refugee, not counting the Palestinians, was 17 years. And you look at Palestinians and you see 60-plus years of refugee status. Comparable figures for internally displaced persons have not been compiled because it's so much more difficult to count, if you will, IDPs. But certainly there could well be similar figures. Increasingly, we're seeing conflict being carried out by groups motivated by personal economic gains. Again, there have always been gangs and people trying to profit from conflict situations, but what seems to be different is that there are more exclusively criminal gangs. It isn't just people kidnapping a few to raise money to fight the cause, but kidnapping a few people to get money for money's sake. A second theme I look at is the urban nature of conflict, as Mike said. You know, and what we see is a convergence of some of these armed groups. They're drug traffickers and terrorists and insurgents and groups motivated by greed, all operating in the same environment and affecting the same urban population. More difficult to respond in urban situations than in rural ones. Yesterday I went to the museum with my sisters and we saw a film on Katrina, and seeing the difference between what happened in New Orleans and the equal devastation on the Gulf Coast illustrated quite starkly the difficulties of responding to different layers of government authorities, more players, more congestion than in rural areas. Finally, I look at climate change and its potential to displace people, large numbers of people, unknown large numbers of people over coming decades. And while there's a lot of uncertainty about the particular effects of climate change, it does seem certain that the severity and intensity and frequency of natural disasters is increasing. We saw last year how the international system found it very difficult to respond to two mega disasters, Haiti and then Pakistan. The prospect of the number of disasters increasing and perhaps intersecting not only with conflict, but also playing out in urban settings creates various nightmare scenarios of the context for future humanitarian action. In my conclusions, I think that the definitions we've used of protection are out of sync with the current challenges we face. I don't think we're well served by the expansive definition of the IESC and the International Committee of the Red Cross. I suggest that we look at different orders of protection. We've done this in the case of natural disasters. It's hard because human rights, by definition, are interconnected and hard to set priorities within, with the right to education is more or less important than the right to food and so on. But I'm suggesting that at least in the humanitarian realm, that we look at physical security or physical protection as different. When my kids were little, I had a friend who had a teenager going through a terrible, terrible spell, you know, drugs and alcohol and dropped out of school and lots. And she would say to me, I've just got to get him to survive. If he can survive these years, we can fix everything else. We can fix the bad grades and the lack of interest in university, but he's got to survive first. So I'm suggesting that physical survival, physical safety needs to be prioritized. Secondly, protection in terms of access to essential life-saving goods. And third, the broader category of human rights. Just as we've learned that when you're digging people out of the rubble after an earthquake, you don't get too concerned about voting rights in those initial days, so too we need to be aware that there are different levels of rights. I make a number of recommendations, what humanitarian actors can and should do. Much of what they're doing and calling protection is wonderful work. It's good programs. It needs to continue. But the problem with calling it protection is that, first of all, it lets governments off the hook. It isn't directed to those who could provide the physical security necessary, such as the police and sometimes the military. And it may create expectations. Oh, we've got a protection program going on in our camp. We'll be safe. So there are some things that humanitarian actors could do different. I think we need to look much more at how communities protect themselves. Communities are the first line of defense. Look more on natural disasters and the impact intersection with conflict. I think humanitarians need to break out of their comfort zone and work more with police and military forces. Many humanitarian actors kind of wish the military weren't involved in these areas, but they are, and they will be, and the kind of dialogue to work out who does what in terms of protecting people is important. The unique role of the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is perhaps the only actor that's been able to maintain its neutrality while protecting people, needs to be upheld and respected. The concept of protection of civilians needs more definition, both at the conceptual level and at the level of operational guidance to peacekeeping operations. UNHCR is already in the process, I believe, of repositioning itself as a displacement agency and not just a refugee agency, and that's a positive trend. Donor governments have an especially important role to play. Donor governments drive the international humanitarian system. The policies and priorities they set, they emphasize, they fund, has a direct impact on the lives of people. So I think that with donor governments to reconceptualize what they mean by protection and the limits of protection would be helpful. And some, I believe, that by acknowledging the limits of humanitarian action in protecting people, perhaps we can protect more people better. Thanks.
Thank you very much, everyone, for coming. And thank you, Elizabeth, for writing this marvelous book. When I first joined the International Rescue Committee, I went to a new employee orientation along with some of my colleagues, And I noticed that some of our staff were talking about protection and some were talking about a separate thing, security. And to me, these things were meant the same thing, but it turned out that they have very specific meanings in our community. And I came to realize that security means the safety of aid workers. Protection was what the beneficiaries of our aid programs needed. In the case of refugees, they may need to have their rights protected. In the case of some internally displaced persons, they need protection from their own governments. And poor and vulnerable people in all sorts of settings where they get aid needed protection from being preyed on or exploited. When my colleagues say protection, they mean programs to enhance the safety and promote the rights of vulnerable people. Later, in speaking to the then director of the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance about training in protection for OFDA staff, he said, when NGOs say protection programs, these programs are not providing physical protection for anyone. And his point is correct. These programs do not guarantee protection the way a bodyguard might aim to protect a Hollywood celebrity or the Secret Service protects the president. In her excellent book, Elizabeth explores the ways protection has been defined and applied by different actors and the development of the protection regime. And she describes, as she has just said, how protection has been stretched to include all manner of important activities. If we look at the International Rescue Committee's activities in terms of protection in Haiti right now, a response to a natural disaster with some very vulnerable people, you will see that we have hired and seconded to the cluster system, the coordinating system that the international community has, a person to help co-lead that cluster, that we have undertaken family tracing and reunification programs. We've also done programs to prevent violence against women. We've had quick impact projects like solar lighting in high-risk areas and consulted with communities on where to place latrines so that there are less risk to women using them in the evenings and at night. In terms of guaranteeing people's rights, we've worked with them just to safeguard their legal documentation. So many lost that in the earthquake. That can include things as simple as making sure they have a Ziploc bag and plastic cases in anticipation of Hurricane Tomas. Working with the National Archives and the Office of National Identification to facilitate replacement documents, information boards, bulletins sent out, making sure people know what's going on, camp management and camp leaders' protection trainings. IRC also tries to combat stigma, rumors, misunderstandings, especially around the time of cholera, work undertaken to counter beliefs about poisonings, curses, and voodoo. I'm also reminded of our work in Darfur before we were sent out of that area by the regime in Khartoum. IRC was helping survivors of rape, and that included gatherings to bring women together. And we had to call them health programs, but they were really intended to protect women and enhance their protection going forward. And this was one of the things that helped us get invited to leave that part of the country. Elizabeth's book, you know, mentions that the lack of a common definition makes it hard to identify patterns of financing for protection and harder to assess performance. I think it's interesting. She could have titled the book Protection and Humanitarian Action. But instead, she says it's the politics of protection and the limits of humanitarian action. And so already just from the cover, you have a sense of how deep she's going to get into this. She's very clear on recognizing that humanitarian aid has been used instead of taking political steps to address and stop end war, conflict, and political strife. Political and diplomatic action is often required to provide real protection. The book is fantastic. I recommend it to everyone starting out in this field because it provides so much. It provides a history of conventions and organizations that today create those elements of the international community that are charged with protecting the vulnerable in one way or another. It's a very important reference. She looks at, over the past 20 years, the fact that there's been a growing recognition of the important roles international organizations play in providing protection, including international NGOs, non-governmental organizations. She reminds us again and again that national governments have the responsibility to protect the citizenry and that communities are often in the lead in protecting themselves. This is a humbling reminder for an NGO representative to read and acknowledge. And Elizabeth is absolutely correct that communities are their own first line of defense. The book does much more. Reader can get an understanding of who the major donor governments are, their priorities and aid trends, up-to-date analysis of military involvement in relief operations and tensions surrounding civil-military relations, description of international humanitarian reform efforts initiated by the UN's Emergency Response Coordinator, and the reform efforts' problems and progress to date. There is also a summary of general UN reform efforts and how these affect protection of civilians. She takes care to explain the differences between the movement calling for greater protection of civilians in conflict and the actions of the UN to take up R2P, or the responsibility to protect, concerning when the rest of the world can intervene. She exhibits a keen understanding of the strengths and limits of international and national non-governmental organizations. And I think this book is very timely. Just on page 2, it talks about the basis of international humanitarian law needed to distinguish between combatants and civilians in war times, and that, of course, was the issue just last week in Libya. Many of her examples relate to issues that I have covered in my job just in the last half dozen years, and I have the sense she's been reading through my email, and it's a kind of spooky thing. And they're right up to date, too, which is another nifty trick when you're writing a book. Elizabeth admits her conclusions are likely to be controversial for humanitarians, notably that humanitarians have expanded the concept of protection so much that it's lost its meaning, and we need to recognize that in spite of all our good intentions and programs, we're often not able to keep people safe. I think Elizabeth has a problem with this book. I think a book this well-researched, informative, and, like the author, fair-minded, is not going to garner any attention. She needs help to stoke more controversy. And she needs to hype the scandals in here to sell it. And luckily in here there are mentions of cover-ups, firings, double dealings, undermining, and even an outraged Frenchman. These are all in here. We just all have to help her to hype them. On page 26 is a dangerous reference to militarized refugee camps. Page 44, a double standard, the UN acts to protect human rights in East Timor and Kosovo, but not Chechnya, Tibet, and Guantanamo. Page 60 is a big charity cover-up. Humanitarian organizations piping down to avoid taking sides in conflicts or politics to keep operating in dicey places. Page 69, hundreds of inexperienced NGOs flood Haiti. Page 77, the USAID administrator threatens to rip up contracts and fire organizations that mention their own names even once in Iraqi villages because he wanted the U.S. government brand recognized. On page 154, undercut. The UN peacekeeping mission in Sudan, UNMISS, is given robust authorities, but is not equipped for robust protection. Page 168, French Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner, here's the Frenchman, argues a right to help in Burma after Cyclone Nargis and invokes a responsibility to protect, or R2P. Page 240, betrayed. Donor governments are too cheap to live up to pledges, fail to follow through on promises to countries in need. Finally, page 247 gets really juicy and discusses paramilitary groups, drug traffickers, and diamond smuggling. If we can just cast a couple really good-looking hot couple with the love scene, I think we can have this made into a movie in no time. So I hope that's whetted your appetite. I learned a lot from reading it, but I also think it's a very important reference, and I thank Elizabeth for writing it.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you, Elizabeth. We're very quickly going to go to you, but I am going to take the prerogative of the chair to ask one question. And I'm tempted to get into specifics, although I think we probably will in the course of the next half hour, of what the book means for what you might say are the ABCDs, Afghanistan, Benghazi, Congo, or today also Cote d'Ivoire, an interesting case study, and then finally Darfur. But if some of those don't come up in your questions and comments, and if they're comments, by the way, please keep them brief. We will allow maybe a one-sentence comment rule, but only en route to a question. And please also identify yourself when you ask. But before you do, my one question is the following. How would you explain where we are today in terms of the scale of the problem that you're grappling with, Elizabeth? In other words, what you've done in the book, I think, extremely eloquently, succinctly, and helpfully, is to explain how the nature of conflicts have changed the dilemma facing those involved in protection and in humanitarian action. But taking even a further step back and saying, how bad has the, in the 1990s, we heard about how the end of the Cold War had unleashed the world for civil conflict. And we saw a lot of the world's worst tragedies that we had seen in years. Now we're two decades after the Cold War. And I'm just wondering how you would explain the magnitude of the problem. It's obviously still serious. Everybody in this room still takes the humanitarian stakes very seriously. I just mentioned four or five cases. But are we seeing any general progress towards a safer world in terms of threats to civilians from violence? So if you could ask approach your subject in those terms, answer that question, and then we'll go to the audience, please.
Sure. Since the end of the Cold War, the number of conflicts in the world has decreased, and the number and percentage of civilians dying or casualties as a result have decreased. The ending of those proxy wars, where the wars dragged on and large numbers of civilians were killed, has decreased. It's hard to grapple with that in the light of the fact that civilians are still routinely killed, maimed, tortured, displaced, injured. I mean, there's still tons of civilians are being hurt, but in the grand scheme of things, things are in fact better. And in part, I think that they're better because as a result of those conflicts in the mid-1990s, which were really a turning point, you see this almost a yearning by the international community to figure out how to do things better to prevent wars and civilian casualties. You know, on the development side, you've got human security developing, and human rights, you've got an expansion. And, you know, these new concepts, there's a yearning on the part of internationals to stop these atrocities, to prevent them from happening. And while they are certainly still going on in the places and 100 others that you mentioned, in the grand scheme of things, things are better than they were in 1990.
Well, that's a hopeful note to begin on, although I'm sure we'll talk about many problems in the rest of the afternoon's discussion. So please, if you'd like to raise your hand, and we'll get a microphone brought to you. We'll begin with the gentleman here on the aisle, and then the lady right behind him second. So please identify yourselves after you've gotten a microphone, and then a brief comment if you wish, but a short, pithy question as well. So right here, third from the back. And stand up if you don't mind so we can see you.
This will need a microphone or?
Yeah, go ahead and try and I'll repeat it if necessary.
All right. My name is Ellen and I did a PhD dissertation about humanitarian intervention. I did a comparative analysis about this thing more. So my question is about military intervention, because there are times that military action is needed.
And my question is about the leadership of the United States, because in military interventions are actually very much an exclusive domain of nation states, because it involves sending of military forces across national boundaries. And it's expensive, and otherwise it's also dangerous. Now, my question is, one of the pillars of the U.S. foreign policy is the protection and the promotion of human rights worldwide. In fact, several U.S. presidents have defended this concept. Clinton said the U.S. is willing to die for, willing to protect people from error, yet Srebrenica, Rwanda, and East Timor happened his watch. And Bush also said that United States is also willing to do that, but still Darfur did happen. And now President Obama, just a few weeks ago, the Obama doctrine has become a byword in international relations now, which he said that the United States is willing to intervene in places where there is massive violation of human rights, even if U.S. national interests are not involved, but U.S. values are. My question is, in your opinion or analysis, is the U.S. ready to assume the leadership in humanitarian intervention? Because it has abandoned that commitment if we see what it did throughout these years from the 90s until now. Thank you.
We'll take a couple of questions.
Let's do that. Yeah, why not? So right next to you.
Okay, I'm Patty. I'm from Interaction, though I have a lot of field experience, so I'm bringing that to my question, which is, it's excellent, you know, to talk about protection in humanitarian crises, and of course, humanitarian crises create new protection issues, but they also exacerbate existing issues. They exacerbate existing rights violations. And so my question is, what do we do? How do we link it as humanitarians, how are we going to link better to what's going on in the development arena so that we're not kind of creating a protection umbrella that isn't going to necessarily be carried forward after or didn't exist before? So that just how you looked at that.
Let me start with the first question. If you look at the development of the concepts of humanitarian intervention back in the early 90s, really around Somalia, and the way it developed over the course of the next decade to become the responsibility to protect endorsed at the World Summit in 2005, you see that, you know, a shift in terms of where the responsibility is placed. Humanitarian intervention, the responsibility is on those who are doing the intervening. Responsibility to protect says it's national governments that are responsible, and the international community has a responsibility to support governments trying to protect their people, to react with a whole range of means if they don't protect their people, and to help them recover. Unfortunately, I think most of the attention focuses on the military intervention. And I think that's partly the fault of the UN and some of the proponents of R2P to not, you know, see the full range of actions that can be taken short of sending in troops. If you look at the criteria spelled out for and responsibility to protect, I think they're just about all met in the case of Libya. You know, is it a serious widespread violations of human rights? Are the intentions to stop the violence? Is it proportional? Is it avoiding civilian casualties? Have other non-military means been tried? I mean, where it falls short is some of the recommendations of the International Commission on Intervention and State Sovereignty to look at the operational level. You know, what are the operational objectives? And there I don't think we've been really clear in the case of Libya. How long will this last? Who does what? That, I think, is probably where the shortcomings are, rather than in terms of the broader issues of whether or not the international community should have done something in Benghazi. The gap between relief and development, since I started work in 1985, it's been an issue every year, and we've never gotten it right. You know, the humanitarians go on, the emergency is over, development actors need to move in, and there's always a gap. You know, I can't even begin to list the number of conferences and books and papers and fervent admonitions that we will do better. Different terminology, now it's called early recovery, but we haven't gotten it right. And until we do, some of these conflicts last longer than necessary. Certainly displaced people and refugees can't go home in places like southern Sudan, even when the conflict has been brought to a formal end, until the infrastructure is in place to support them. So we need to keep on working on it, and maybe somebody will come up with another term that will make it more palatable to the various actors.
Anne?
On the first question, you know, I think one of the issues in Rwanda, and if you wrote your PhD on this, perhaps you know this well, was that in the U.S. government, there was a long list of checklist of questions that had to be answered before a decision to go in could be taken. And clearly, that's not what's been used with making the decision to go to institute a no-fly zone in Libya. And I think that's right. I mean, I think that in the first instance of Rwanda, that, you know, speed was essential. And that looking for the perfect answer, which is a political requirement, a domestic political requirement, you just never have that if you're trying to save people's lives. So I think that this is very hard within the U.S. government to be able to move quickly to plan and answer questions and anticipate all the, you know, myriad follow-on issues that come up from a crisis like this. And I think the other issue that is many of us are asking ourselves right now is, you know, why here and not here? And I don't think the U.S. has good answers on that right now. I mean, I think there are answers, but we don't always articulate them.
France and the UN may have come closer to an answer today with the arrest of Mr. Gbagbo from Ivory Coast, as some of you may have heard. I just want to make one quick comment on Libya, which gets to the dilemma of the politics of protection, the limits of humanitarian intervention. I don't want to obviously speak for Elizabeth, but she's helped me crystallize this thought in my head. What should someone who's interested in humanitarian protection do if and when the Libya conflict seems to not only stagnate and stalemate, as it seems to be right now, but perhaps even trend in the favor of the Gaddafi forces? And then what is the next step to recommend rather than perhaps face the possibility, if not at some point the likelihood, of Benghazi and other cities in the east being threatened? I'm not saying this is inevitable, but I think as a military analyst, which is primarily what I am, it is possible. And then your options become watch them lose and be overrun, give them defensive arms, perhaps with special forces and CIA operatives on the ground, which aren't the kind of people who tend to make the humanitarian community feel all comfortable about association, or get more muscular in our own role. And I'll just leave that as a set of unpalatable options that I think that we may have to face, even though I obviously hope that we won't. And let's go to some additional questions. Yes, ma'am, in the pink jacket.
Hi, my name is Sarah Williamson. I'm with the Global Emergency Group. And Elizabeth, my question is, do you think it's necessary as a humanitarian community for us to come up with one common definition of protection? And if so, how do you think we would get there? How would that come about?
Shall we take one more? Mm-hmm. Here in the purple.
My name is Tamaris Kotouzas. I'm a student at SAIS, Human Development and Economics. After the Katrina catastrophe, Cuba offered 1,500 medical staff, which the U.S. government refused to host. And at the same time, we're seeing in Afghanistan international NGOs with the financing of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation working with Taliban to eradicate polio. What are some of the ethical questions about partnerships, and how can you insulate humanitarian action from politics or low politics?
Okay, let me start with the first question about how do we get to one common definition. You know, the humanitarian world now has thousands of actors. I mean, local NGOs and international and governments and militaries and bilateral, I mean, all levels. And to get to one common definition took the International Committee of the Red Cross at least a decade. I mean, a whole series of consultations and talking through. And, you know, frankly, I'm not sure that that would be the most productive use of time, given the humanitarian crisis in the world, to spend a lot of time working on definitions. If we could agree that, you know, different groups do different things well, and if we could agree that on the importance of physical safety and that not everything that we call protection is, in fact, protection, I think we'd be going a long, long way. I participated in those consultations of the ICRC, and they were tortured. I mean, for me, it is really awful to think about the protection cluster in Haiti, given the horrible protection needs in the country, spending 6 months talking about what do we mean by protection. Trying to come up with a common understanding of a concept is I don't think, the best use of time. And, you know, the larger question of how you begin to coordinate with these thousands of actors. You know, when there are 500 organizations participating in the regular meetings of the health cluster in Haiti, how do you talk about coordination that is anything more than just a brief, you know, tour of the room saying what we're doing? You know, so I think the challenges of coordination are much, much greater. Working with non-state actors is a real challenge. You know, under international humanitarian law, they have certain obligations. Non-state actors are, you know, everything from the Taliban to, you know, drug dealers to groups that have a certain legitimacy in the community, such as Hamas and Hezbollah, in their communities are known as social service providers and have provided tremendous amounts of resources, and sometimes in ways that the more established actors haven't been able to do. But in terms of engaging with them to enable humanitarian access and humanitarian assistance, you know, some organizations do that much better than others. ICRC says, you know, we don't talk about, we talk about all parties to the conflict, not good guys and bad guys. We don't make value judgments. But for many of us, it's difficult not to make value judgments when you see the particular political agendas. But maybe Ann wants to say something about, particularly about Katrina and the Cubans and so on.
Yeah, that's funny. The U.S. Wasn't going to accept the Cubans into the U.S. And, you know, there was a propaganda story going on both directions at that point, but also the Mexican military wanted to respond, and they wanted to set up health programs in Louisiana, and they were invited instead to cook meals and serve them in Texas. So, you know, everybody got sort of less than the best treatment in that story. But clearly the U.S. government was very clear on the Cuban proposal. But the Cubans, I think, have responded in Haiti. Mm-hmm. And some of the best responders in Haiti, in like Cité du Soleil, are from the slums of Rio. So it's very interesting ways that offers from overseas can sometimes be accepted. You know, the Canadians are very good at talking about that they can sometimes offer things that Americans can't because they're a medium-sized country. And you think differently. You have different expectations, and you arrange your responses differently. So thanks for asking the question, Stamatis. Sarah was asking a question about
that common definition.
Oh, yeah. What I was going to say is, you know, in listening to you before, Elizabeth, you were mentioning how important it was to save people's lives first and foremost, and then also to make sure they were fed and given clean water, and I completely agree with that. But you don't want to wait too long before you look at the types of activities that our folks do to enhance protection, because I think of things, for example, in the spontaneous settlements in Haiti, where our staff will help women in the community organize themselves to do sort of the equivalent of a neighborhood watch. And, you know, we could have argued, well, these spontaneous settlements are temporary, so that's not a priority. But now here we are, well over a year later, and people are still living in these situations. So I think that that type of self-protection and helping people, as you said, communities protect themselves, and helping them to do that, to think through what's needed to be done and to give them a little more wherewithal to get themselves organized to protect themselves is well worth the investment.
Maybe if I could just comment on the community self-protection. I mean, I agree that there are important ways that communities can and do protect themselves, but sometimes those are pretty bad ways. I mean, for example, we recently commissioned some studies, and found that very effective ways of protecting yourself are to become displaced, to pay off a warlord, to pay taxes to an insurgent group, sometimes to give one of your children to a militia group so they leave the rest of you alone. I mean, those may be effective self-protection strategies, but they're really hard for internationals to support. You know, yeah, go ahead and pay those bribes to the warlord to keep you safe while we run our programs over here. I think we need to understand better how communities protect themselves. And some of the neighborhood watch communities in Haiti are providing much more effective protection than anybody else.
Over here, yes. Second to last row in the purple.
Hi, my name is Melissa Famula, and I'm a recent graduate from SAIS. Excuse me, and I had a question about new media. I wanted to know if you thought that the existence of new media, including Twitter, Facebook, things like that, and the immediacy of what news is provided has either facilitated protection or hindered it. Thank you.
And we'll go all the way to the back of the room, and then all the way to the side, so we'll take three together.
Dan Sullivan with Save Darfur Coalition Genocide Intervention Network. Elizabeth, you talked earlier about that fine line between being neutral and then taking sides. But it also seems like once you go over that line, there's different degrees. So in Libya, you know, the purpose isn't helping the rebels to gain victory, but you are in effect helping them. And then in South Sudan, the new mission, UN mission there, there's a lot of concern about having to work with the SPLA and helping them out, and how you protect civilians and work within that when they're blocking access. So is there are there any general rules for how far you go, or is that really just a case-by-case basis?
And if you like, we can take one more over here on the side. Is that okay?
Thank you. My name is Zalia Woolsey. My question is regarding aid, specifically American aid, to two countries, Egypt and Israel. In the case of Egypt, that aid was used and turned against the people allowing a dictator to stay in power for many, many years. In the case of Israel, military aid is given, plentiful, and then those weapons are then used to, in the case of Gaza, bomb the only flour mill and bomb necessary fuel facilities. How can you carry on providing military aid to dictatorships and then say, not do, turn a blind eye?
Let me start with a question about new media. I think that it is transforming the humanitarian response just because you can watch it unfold in real time. I'm not really a Twitter person, but I was captivated by the messages coming out of Tunisia by UN staff. It was, you know, UN staff were saying, we hear gunfire, 500 people are arriving. This is what they're saying in these short little messages happening right now. I think that the immediacy is leading both to a generous outpouring of compassion in terms of being able to see what's happening. And it raises some difficult ethical issues, particularly around tracing. You know, in Haiti, we found this child. Anybody know this child? ICRC has, you know, for years done tracing, but has safeguards. Not just anybody can claim a child. And so there are some issues around that. The media in general, is they're an actor in humanitarian response. It isn't just a group covering what the humanitarians are doing. They are in there. The rise of celebrity humanitarianism, certainly drawing more attention to issues, but sometimes also oversimplifying conflicts and situations in ways that may be detrimental to the long term. Some of the very controversial writing about Burma, Myanmar is raising questions, for example, about the extent to which celebrity activism has perhaps contributed to seeing issues of black and white that are actually much more gray. Humanitarian assistance is a resource during conflicts. I mean, it can be used by various groups. You work through one local partner, that local partner's standing in the community can increase. You know, these are economic resources in places where there is a scarcity of resources. I think that one of the things humanitarians have learned over the past decade or so is the principle of do no harm. Make sure you know who's getting the food and how it might be used and who's actually distributing it or selling it or using it for political gain. It's a myth to think that humanitarian assistance is always apolitical. I mean, putting large amounts of money into poor societies always has political consequences. You know, social relationships can change. The internationals come in and build a school that lets girls go to school. I mean, that's something we don't do in our culture, is that, you know, there are political consequences, and I think that the idea is not to say that they should all be apolitical, but to recognize what are some of the implications of this. The question of aid to Egypt and Israel, I think, is a broader question of U.S. foreign policy in terms of where the money goes. But certainly in the case of Gaza, I mean, you have on the one hand UNRWA, which is the U.N. agency set up to deal with Palestinian refugees, which has over the years moved to incorporate a little bit of protection, although it doesn't have a formal protection mandate, in its work with Palestinian refugees, finding spaces and ways of maneuvering to try to keep people safe. But when the Operation Cast Lead occurred in January 2009, UNRWA, for all of its emphasis on protection, was powerless to protect civilians from bombs that were falling. It was a political action that was necessary, and, you know, to have a ceasefire, to have an end to the bombing. All of UNRWA's great work in terms of protecting people really fell by the wayside when it came down to the overwhelming preponderance of power on one side.
One last round of questions, if anyone has one or two more. Man, we'll start here in the front row, and then anybody else who may want one, and we'll finish up.
Thank you. I want to thank Elizabeth for writing the book and Brookings for having somebody like this on their staff. The challenge that you were talking about, all aid is political. All aid has impact. And the question is, when you look at what international aid is, international humanitarian aid for disasters is larger now than development aid. The total development budget for the UN, for the U.S., USAID, is about $2.5 billion. Whereas when you look at all of the humanitarian contributions, they're getting very close to that level as well, $800 million in disaster relief and $1.8 billion in refugee assistance. So the question is, how do we How do we make these things better? I mean, you talked about the things, the sphere standards, and about the cluster and the try to improve coordination. But how do you think we get people to understand the impact of some of these things, to tie some of our foreign policy, and to get the real political and diplomatic attention that we need, particularly to resolve situations of internal displacement and for making it possible for refugees really to go home? How do you make that part of a national agenda, a humanitarian agenda?
And if there's one last question, we can take that, and then we'll wrap up.
The question is regarding the protection of civilians from violence, particularly organized violence. To what extent can non-government groups play a role in that, or is that something that should, ought to be, must be reserved to sovereign military forces?
And if you don't mind, there was one more right behind, so we'll take that and then go straight to you folks for
My name is Mia. I'm in the Marine Corps, and my question is biased to that. Is there a negative stigma attached to military involvement in humanitarian aid? And if so, how do you improve it? Is there something that can be done about it?
Over to you.
Okay, lots of big questions. How do you get attention from foreign policy actors to perhaps shift the balance? Something is wrong when we're spending so much money on humanitarian response in comparison with long-term development. When it's done right, and there are tons of good examples, long-term development assistance can help ease tensions in a community, make conflict less likely, and certainly your money goes a lot further with development assistance than humanitarian. It's easier to work through local groups to get food and water to, sufficient for a community to airlift it in or truck it through dangerous. So it makes a lot of sense. I don't know, Don, how you get the attention of foreign policy makers. One of the trends has been, look at it over the years, you see more and more money going to humanitarian work, more and more, higher and higher percentage of that. Humanitarian politics used to be kind of on the margins of the hard politics that Mike works on, do hard security, military defense, and this humanitarian stuff was kind of soft on the margins. That's not the case anymore. What's driving the situation in Libya right now is humanitarian access. How do we get food in? Let's have a ceasefire. You see the importance of the humanitarian dimension for the political and the security in ways that are new. And that may be the answer. I can remember meeting with a group of U.S. NGOs a few years ago saying, can you please write an article saying that Iraqi refugees are a security concern? Because if you do that, we have a chance of getting more money from Congress. If it's just compassion, well, that doesn't go that far. But if it's security, but there's a danger in securitizing humanitarian efforts and having you think that all refugees are terrorists, because that is certainly not the truth. But I think that grappling with those issues, even though there aren't any easy answers, is the solution. In terms of the last question, the negative stigma around humanitarian work, I think it depends on who you talk with. A lot of humanitarian actors from civilian backgrounds that have worked in the field with the military have tremendous appreciation for how quickly they get things done, how easy it is to work with them compared with the chaos of the NGO world. I remember being in Macedonia working with Albanian and Kosovar refugees, and NGOs just being absolutely entranced that they could say to the military, hey, we need a road here, and voila, it was there. There weren't long discussions about what kind of road, where are we going to put it, who's going to do what. It just happened. And relations can be quite good. Where it gets sticky is in these principles of neutrality. If humanitarians go in and don't see themselves as an arm of U.S. foreign policy, they're independent, neutral humanitarian actors. But because the U.S. is a belligerent in a country like Afghanistan, they're perceived as part of the U.S. effort in ways that may affect their security, their ability to access populations. It makes it that blurring of the lines becomes quite difficult. In a way, I think it's much easier if things can be clear. Military, you do this. You do control tower in Haiti. You have civilians, you distribute water. I say in the book, I think a lot of times military efforts to distribute humanitarian goods aren't very good, and a lot of civilian efforts to protect people aren't very good. But there ought to be some way of using the comparative advantage there in ways that are more helpful. You talked about ownership. I'm sorry, I missed the second question. Protection of civilians, organized violence.
The question was essentially in terms of protecting civilians from organized violence.
From organized violence.
It must be done by sovereign
Yeah, protecting people from organized violence. I mean, the International Committee of the Red Cross is doing some fascinating work these days. You know, guardian of international humanitarian law, laws of conflict, armed violence. You know, they're working in the favelas of Brazil and some of the tough urban neighborhoods in Medellin, Colombia, where there are not overt conflicts going on at the national level. I think that, in fact, that a lot of organizations, humanitarian organizations, are working in neighborhoods with organized violence and are doing so more or less effectively. Sometimes that means negotiating with them, questions of access, at least understanding the dynamics of not being caught in the crossfire between different types of organized, of gangs, if you will. But I think that's really the future of humanitarian work, is that intersection between gangs and other forms of armed groups.
Maybe just to add a couple quick things. I think this there's at least a couple places where there's a need for a lot more work in order to reduce tensions between aid workers and folks who are on the ground where we're also working. So in terms of civil-military relationships, you know, it's not an issue with natural disasters. It's an issue where there is combat going on or the fringes of combat. And there we would call some of what the military does relief operations rather than humanitarian because, as Elizabeth explains, the whole idea behind humanitarian principles was independence, humanity, impartiality, neutrality, and that's not what's motivating most militaries get involved in relief work on the edges of combat. I think NGOs could do a much better job, though, of talking to the military here and overseas in capital cities, not necessarily outside capital cities, but and we could do a lot better getting our story told in doctrine, leadership and ethics training, joint exercises, and because there's a lot more military, U.S. military especially, than there are NGO personnel. We have to be smart about it and look for those nodes where we can reach a lot of people, like before they deploy to places like Afghanistan and Iraq, or, you know, as they come up through the service academies or officer training. And this is something that I'm talking to folks at the Joint Chiefs about, because the tensions just don't help us that much at all. The other place, I think, in terms of this protection work, I think that NGOs have to do a better job describing what it is we're doing and the value of it to the public. And, you know, the public supports that sort of traditional photo of the doctor in the jungle vaccinating the baby and, you know, something that the well being dug and the children drinking the fresh water. If you show a photo of protection work, it may just be women sitting in a circle inside a, you know, a room. That doesn't really illustrate it. And so I think it's harder for people to imagine it, understand it, and I think we could do a better job discussing it. What I have seen is that most aid agencies do now talk about aiding and protecting people overseas and not just aiding them.
Well, thank you, Anne. And I want to say briefly that it's been, for me, not only an educational afternoon and a very educational book, and one that calls us all to action, but also one that's hopeful. And I appreciate the hopeful tone in a lot of what you've written and said today as well. So please, everyone, join me in congratulating Elizabeth.